afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Indie Business Radio for Monday, October 29th, 2007. I'm your host, Donna Maria, and you have arrived at the one place where we empower you to enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way. Today's show is sponsored by Sunrose Aromatics, 100% pure and natural essential oils, including rare and exotic ones like chocolate peppermint, real vanilla, and even butter. Who knew you could get fragrant oils from these types of materials? Let Sunrose help you acquire the oils you need to start or advance your aromatherapy business today. Learn more at sunrosearomatics.com. Well, there's no shortage of talk these days about how having passion can help you achieve your business goals. But what exactly does that mean? Where does the kind of passion we need to be successful really come from? Are some of us born with it, or is it something that we can cultivate and groom over time? Our guest today is Mark Sanborn, an international best-selling author and noted authority on leadership, team building, and customer service. And his work is all about helping others create the kind of passion that they need to be successful in business. Mark has authored 6 books and nearly 24 audio and video training programs on the topics of organizational excellence and extraordinary living. One of his books, The Fred Factor, debuted as a Wall Street Journal bestseller and was named by Publishers Weekly as one of the top 100 best-selling nonfiction titles of 2004. In The Fred Factor, Mark shows us how to use passion to continually create new value for those with whom we work and live, and in our case as indie business owners, the customers and clients we serve. We'll take your questions and comments at 800-773-0355, or you can email your questions to info@indiebusinessradio.com. Mark, welcome to Indie Business Radio.
Thanks, Donna Maria. It's good to be with you.
Well, Mark, you know, that word passion is just tossed around these days by everybody. I mean, everywhere I go and every show I listen to talks about passion in one form or another. So we're going to really delve into what that means and how we can use it to further our lives and especially our businesses. But Mark, can we start off by getting some information from you about who you are? Where did you come from? How did you get into this passion and extraordinary living arena?
The planet Pluton in the third solar system is originally where I'm from, brought to Earth by aliens. No, I grew up on a farm in Northeast Ohio. I'm an old farm boy and I haven't been on the farm for many years, but because of my involvement in agriculture, I got started in public speaking in 4-H. 4-H is a youth organization, and my club needed someone to represent them in the safety speaking contest, and I didn't think it could be that hard. I thought I could think my way to a fairly good speech and found out speaking was very hard, and I did really badly. And fortunately, because I did badly, I got challenged to try again and keep entering contests. You know, sometimes people think that failure is demoralizing, but I think just as often, success can be a negative effect, because if you have moderate success the first time you do something, you figure, why try again? You know, I've already got this figured out. And so for me, it was because of that bad first speech that I delved into learning how to be a good communicator and a good public speaker. Later, I served as state and national president of the FFA organization and then really got started on a career both in speaking. I worked my way through college as an after-dinner speaker and also leadership development, which is really my primary focus and passion now. I was in sales and marketing, started speaking full-time in 1986, and started writing books in 1990. And today, after 21 years in the speaking business full-time and after 8 books, you know, the communicating ideas in the printed and spoken word is really what I'm about.
And Mark, it sounds like, I mean, most of the speakers that I talk with have had a long career doing something totally different from speaking before they started. It sounds like this was kind of innate for you as a Ohio farm boy. As you said, this is something that was always inside of you.
Well, certainly the skill was something that was important, and communication skills, both interpersonal and public, are critical for leaders, and I learned that early on, that was probably the singular most important skill, or the way that the leader connects his or her ideas and vision to the people who help make them a reality. So I think it's natural that In the early years when I was in the sales and marketing profession within the publishing industry, that my communication skills were an integral part of my success there. So I think it's interesting that really we all have a certain expertise within us, and that it's how we, you know, communicate or distribute that expertise, whether it's through teaching or through, you know, the healing profession of healthcare or through the legal profession of law. You know, it's that internal expertise that expresses itself in different ways. And for me, I was always interested in public speaking, and when I realized that I could make a viable living doing that, that's what I pursued.
And so you've got a passion for this, and plus you're obviously really good at it. So let's talk for a second about that passion kind of thing. I was listening to Donald Trump, I think it was, on some TV show not too long ago, talking about you have to have passion, you have to have passion. That's easy to say when you're, you know, gold-plated, you know, telephones in your house. What exactly does it mean to you to convey to someone that they need to have passion?
Well, I, first of all, probably wouldn't begin by saying you need to have passion. I think passion is more often something that's uncovered or discovered rather than created. I think passion is innate to what we like and enjoy and what we find value in. I think a lot of people have passion that just doesn't express itself, and that because we don't see that passion expressed in their work or in their lives, we think they're passionless. I'm not sure that's always the case. I don't know who originally said this, but I thought there was a lot of insight in the comment that a cynic is only a passionate person who doesn't want to be disappointed again. And that over time, you know, as we grow up in our culture, that some of the things that we were excited about as kids, other people made fun of or didn't share our enthusiasm for, and is kind of a, perhaps, any, you know, a defensive mechanism, we became much more, we started living life much more close to the vest. So I think, first of all, passion is about really being in touch with what's important to you. When you know what's important to you and you're doing what you enjoy doing, passion almost always, you know, it comes out. I mean, it's almost like you'd have to block it to prevent it from expressing itself. So when somebody like Donald Trump says you got to have passion, I think that that also points out another problem, is that most people, I think, confuse passion with ego and arrogance and ambition. I think Donald Trump, and I don't know, he seems to be passionate, but I also know he has a high level of confidence and he's incredibly ego-driven. And all of those are fuels, if you will. You know, they're emotional fuel. They don't all work the same way, however. I think, you know, being ego-driven is about proving oneself. I think that passionate people aren't necessarily trying to prove themselves. They're just doing what they enjoy doing and think is important to do. So first and foremost, passion is an emotion. And it's emotion that's a positive emotion related to feeling that what we're doing is enjoyable and that it's important and that it matches our value system. So it's about uncovering that passion that's latent in most people and then expressing it in the way we interact with the world around us.
So you're starting with something that's intangible, the passion, the emotion, and you're translating it or reworking it so that it creates something that's more tangible.
Well, it's like any emotion. You know, you can't touch or see or feel an attitude. People say that, you know, that they can tell when someone has a positive attitude, and they're speaking kind of loosely, because really all you can tell is what someone's doing and how they're doing it. If I were a really good actor, let's just, for purposes of mental stimulation, assume that I'm a really accomplished actor, and that in real life I'm a pretty dour and bitter person, but I get a role in a movie where I play a very positive, upbeat person. If I'm a good actor, I can make you think I've got a great attitude.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is I might be playing a role. You know, I probably, you know, wouldn't be able to sustain that outside of the, you know, the filming of the movie. But the point is that what we often think we understand is someone's attitude is really, in the case with most things in life, what we observe in the way they interact, the way they behave, the things they say and how they say them. So I think it's, you know, it's about learning to make that inner passion, and if you will, congruent with our behaviors and our communications.
And Mark, this is a really good way to introduce everyone to Fred. And, you know, one of the things that is so interesting to me about this book is that the entire book is built on your observance of one person who was passionate about something that he did in his life. Tell us about how you met Fred and how he inspired you to write this book.
Well, I moved to Denver back in 1986. In 1987, I bought a house in an area of town called Washington Park. It's near downtown Denver, a really nice, what I used to call an inner city suburb. You know, it's a neighborhood within the Denver metropolitan area. And Fred was my postal carrier. And Fred, by the way, is an extraordinary human being. He does a very simple job in an extraordinary way. And he is passionate about what he does. But my guess is that 9 out of 10 people that met Fred would not necessarily think he was passionate. He's very quiet. He's very personable, but he would much prefer to interact one-on-one than he would with a large group. He's not loud. He isn't, you know, over-the-top enthusiastic. It's, again, his passion is demonstrated by how he does his work, not by, you know, his you know, tangible enthusiasm or his, you know, the lip service that he pays to it. He just does an extraordinary job, and frankly, he couldn't do the kind of job taking care of all the people on his route that he did if he wasn't passionate about delivering the mail in an extraordinary and excellent way. So if your readers are interested, the story of Fred is at www.fredfactor.com, and they can download or print out the first chapter of the book, which talks about how I first met Fred and talks about why he is exceptional and why he is very different than most postal carriers than anyone else would have ever met.
And Mark, there was about 10 years between the time that you met Fred and the time that the Fred Factor came out. Were you paying close attention to him for all those 10 years and observing him? How's the time distance between meeting him and writing this book?
Well, the time distance is pretty simple. Actually, I met Fred back in 88, and the book is more like 15 years, really. The book didn't come out until 2003, the first version of the book. And the difference was I spoke about Fred a lot in my work. I often told the story he was unequivocally the most requested story, if you will, in my repertoire as a speaker. But I was unable to sell the book to a publisher. I started probably in the mid-90s, and after a few years just kind of gave up because I couldn't get any interest. And so the practical explanation for that is probably that, A, I didn't have a publisher, but B, I think that the intervening years probably enabled me to you know, kind of hone the message down and really polish it. Fred and I have been friends since we first met, and even though I no longer live in the neighborhood where he delivers mail, my wife Darla and I periodically have dinner with Fred and his wife Kathy. So we're still involved in each other's lives, and we're still friends. But the primary reason there was a lag time was no publisher until around 2003 shared my belief that the Fred Factor was an important book, not only that the message was important, but that people would buy it. And fortunately, over a million people in the world have bought it, so I feel a little validated that I must have been right about the importance of the message.
Yeah, and I think certainly the timing is good, and you did manage to put a whole lot of great nuggets into a small amount of space, and we appreciate that. We're going to come back in a few minutes and talk more with Fred. Not Fred. He's
Oh, I'm often called Fred.
I hope I'm not the first person to do that.
No, you're not. No.
Mark Sanborn, author of The Fred Factor. We're going to come back in a few minutes and talk with him about his four principles to become a Fred ourselves. This is Indie Business Radio. We'll be right back.
Why is everyone listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com? Because it's the future of talk radio. Every day, more and more people are finding internet radio as not just an alternative media, but as a replacement to traditional AM and FM broadcast stations. Internet radio offers a wider variety of programs, convenient on-demand listening that meets your schedule, and fewer commercial interruptions. And GlobalTalkRadio.com is already leading the way by matching this content with a highly targeted internet audience. GlobalTalkRadio.com offers its listeners one of the widest programming varieties on the internet, from business and finance to self-improvement, paranormal, health, literature, romance, politics, and more. There are also opportunities for prospective hosts who would like to host their own weekly or one-time talk shows. Want to learn more? Check us out at www.globaltalkradio.com and see the future of talk radio today.
Welcome back to Indie Business Radio. We're here this afternoon with author Mark Sanborn. He wrote the best-selling book, The Fred Factor, which is a fantastic book that really covers what he calls the Fred principles. And these are principles to help us as ordinary people live extraordinary lives. Let's talk about those for a second, Mark. What are the four Fred principles, and how can small business owners best use them?
Sure. Well, principle is important because times change, but principles are timeless. You know, they're true across time, and they're true across culture, and they're true across context. So all of my work in leadership development and service strategy and performances are based on principles. And Fred exemplifies these principles. He didn't invent them, and they weren't, you know, unique to him. But I think that Fred is a template for what most people who do continually create new value for customers, colleagues, and the people they live with, what most of those people do to achieve those results. And the first principle is really critical because it's the point that everybody makes a difference. That's significantly different than what we've been told. You know, most of us grew up being told we could make a difference, which of course suggests that, you know, we might choose not to make a difference. And I think that the bigger point is that we all make a difference, and at the end of the day, the only question is, what kind of difference did you make? Did you add to or take away from the experience of your the people you live and work with? Did you do something positive or something negative? Now, there's the skeptic who would say, well, you know, but what about the neutral people? And the point I want to make about that is that when we meet somebody in life who's neutral, we don't say they're neutral. We usually, right or wrong, think they're indifferent. Because the neutral people are the people who kind of give off this vibe that says, you know, I'm not going to, you know, dirty my hands by becoming involved with you and your problems in your life. I'm going to remain neutral. And that unwillingness to engage others, again, right or wrong, is engaged as indifference. And that's why I think that we have to, as leaders, first and foremost, and as parents, prove significance to others. Because if our kids don't feel significant, they won't know that they can make significant contributions. If an employee doesn't feel significant, he or she won't know that they can make a significant contribution. So the first principle is that everybody makes a difference. And the question is, what kind of difference are you making?
So, Mark, as a business owner, does that kind of boil down to what kind of difference are you going to make in my life today as your customer, as your client? Like, what's in it for me?
As a business owner, what it boils down to is that people are basically keeping an unspoken and maybe even subconscious score of, was there anything positively different about doing business with you as an entrepreneur, as a business owner? And if there wasn't, over time, they'll naturally migrate to those extraordinary service providers. You know, even though people have become intimately familiar, and sometimes we take successful businesses and we talk about them so much that we kind of create an aversion to hearing another example. But, you know, there have been coffee shops historically for years. But Starbucks really put the whole formula together. They really cracked the code on doing a lot of little things different and better. And as we'll see as we cover the next few principles, I think harnessing, although they didn't obviously think of them in these terms, harnessing the principles of the Fred Factor.
Right, right. It's, yeah, Starbucks, I know from your book that's one, they certainly harnessed you there, didn't they?
Yeah, well, I've certainly become an addict, that's for sure.
And you know, Mark, I when I read your book, I said, you know what, I'm going to test this out on my little girl. She's 6 years old. The principle that you talked about in terms of, you know, it's not whether you're going to make a difference, it's what kind of difference you're going to make. So this morning when she got up for school, I asked her, what was she going to do today to make a difference in her day? And so she kind of looked at me really strange. I hadn't quite put it that way before. She said, I'm going to hug my teacher.
There you go. Well, you know, and I'm glad you brought that up because we're going to come back to this probably towards the end of the interview, but I think the first step in getting people to embrace these principles is awareness. And I think you just demonstrated exactly what I meant when I said the first job of leadership and the first job of parenting is to prove significance to others. I mean, you knew that your little girl could choose to make a difference at any age. But if she's not thinking about that, you know, she's distracted by all the things we're all distracted by. Little kids have even shorter attention spans than big kids. So it was a simple matter of planting that awareness. Hey, hon, what are you going to do to make a difference today? You are a difference maker. Not, you know, I think sometimes, we kind of make it retroactive. Did you do anything today that was, you know, important or different or extraordinary? I think that question is best asked at the beginning of the day so that it becomes an awareness on the part of the person who we're communicating with.
You can kind of put that intention out there. And, you know, just since reading your book, I have become more aware of, for example, I deal a lot with my customers and clients on email. I have become more aware about how I draft my email messages. And obviously, you know, you get those automated email responses from people that say, you know, I just wanted to know I got your email, but I'm only checking email once a day today because I'm so busy and, you know, I just had to change everything, so I may not get back to you today. And just kind of this long message about how come they're not writing me back today. One of the things I did just intentionally over the past week or so since I focused on this principle was, you know, I send back the meat of the message, you know, the crux of the matter that I had to get to, and then I put around it, you know, some niceties and some things to let the person know that I'm concerned not just about their functional business question, but also about them and how their business is going. And, you know, the responses I get back are, you know, thank you for asking me that. You know, you made me feel really positive about what I'm doing today.
Well, that's the second, and that's the second, excuse me for interrupting, but I get excited. That's the second principle, and again, it's a beautiful segue in that everything's built on relationship. And my friend Harry Beckwith says something, and I've started to paraphrase, and I'm not sure how close it is to what he originally said, but I know it's close in spirit, and that is, you know, quality and service get you into the game, but relationship wins the game. You know, people aren't going to do business with you in 2007 and beyond just because they like you. I mean, that's just not the way the world works. But I guarantee you, even if you have the best value proposition, the best prices, they will choose not to do business with you if they don't like you. And I'm the same way. You know, sometimes we get very transactional, and certainly email is, you know, kind of a curse that we all face. But I have found, like you, that just even sometimes when I, you know, and my PDA is terrible because I'm typing with my thumb,
right?
So it's a little hard to do a lot of relationship building. But I've found that sometimes I have to remind myself just to put the, you know, hello, Donna Maria, because
right.
Sometimes somebody will say, you know, where are we at on that project? And I'll email back, you know, more, I'll get back to you tomorrow. Well, nothing wrong with that. There's nothing sinful or inappropriate. It's just that we enhance everything we do when we focus a little bit on the relationship. And the tragedy is, and it's true, we know we can't build relationships with everybody we meet every day. We never get anything done. But the tragedy of the modern workplace is because we can't build relationships with everybody, we'll often go days or weeks and not build them with anybody.
Yeah.
And that's really the message of the book. The book isn't some kind of touchy-feely, you know, join hands and sing kumbaya with everybody you meet every day. You know, I'm a business person, and I'm a pretty productive guy. It's just reminding ourselves that, you know, to keep the humanity in what we're doing, because technology, as wonderful as it is, has a tendency to drive out the humanness, if you will, the humanity of our exchanges.
And do you find too, Mark, that in this principle number two, which is success being built on relationships, that even when you do reach out to, you know, the 3 out of every 50 people that you have time to in that way, that kind of attitude transcends those 3 actions and really sort of magnifies itself in all aspects of your business?
Oh, it's definitely. I mean, most things that we do, good or bad, are habitual. And the way we develop good habits is by paying attention to them and making them intentional, at least for the beginning. I also think that, you know, the one thing I would impress on your listeners is I'm not in any way advocating, you know, this kind of ATM mentality that says, oh, I need a relationship, I'm going to stick my, you know, plastic card in a machine and money will pop out. You know, being interested in people has got to be something you fundamentally and genuinely do. I'll never write a book called 6 Steps to Tricking People into Thinking You're Interested. But I got to tell you, the reality is it'd be a bestseller, because we live in a culture that would much rather take the shortcut than pay the price or, you know, invest in the relationship. And, unfortunately, there are no shortcuts. I think people today are pretty savvy, and if they think that what you're doing, I have a, And of course, I won't make any friends with this, but, and I'll probably get fewer of them this year, but I got a problem with electronic or email Christmas cards. And by the way, I don't mind getting them. I mean, it takes me 3 seconds to look at them and delete them. But what it says is, if it's an unimportant relationship, then I go, well, of course they sent an email because they're not going to invest a lot of time. We're just acquaintances. But, you know, if I sent my mother an email Christmas card, yeah, I guarantee that would be a reflection on a problem in our relationship. You know, if I sent it to my wife or my kids, and I think the same is true with clients. I just got an invitation from a colleague of mine to a reception they're having to launch a new business. And the invitation was really classy, but he wrote about 4 or 5 sentences, handwritten. Now, there's a good example of somebody that values a relationship. You know, I've got all the information, but I'm thinking now, man, I've got to make it a point to go to Harv's reception because he obviously values a relationship.
Well, the beauty of the listeners to the Indie Business Radio Show is that we have that passion that we can use to connect those kinds of things, like the email message, and, you know, I'm not talking about putting an ATM card into the machine either, but when you have that passion and you can connect it to those activities, then it really is genuine.
Yeah, and email is a great communication tool. I mean, I think the value of email is timeliness. I mean, I put a card in the mail today, it's going to take at least a minimum of 24 to 72 hours to get somewhere.
Right.
You know, and so timeliness is important. But
I may not get in the box at all.
Yeah, you know, John Maxwell, who I've become friends with over the years and whose work I respect, John has a wonderful phrase. He says, when you value people, you add value to them. And I think that's one of the great things entrepreneurs and good managers and good leaders do, is that by valuing people, we actually increase their value.
Well, and principle number 3 is continually creating value for people.
Yeah, and here's the big secret of entrepreneurs. You know, money is not a resource. I'm an economist by training, believe it or not. You know, money is really a byproduct of the only 3 resources we ever get, and that's our time, our expertise, and the time and expertise of the people on our team. So whether you're a Lone Ranger or you got, you know, 700 employees, it's how you focus your time and expertise and the time and expertise of others that determines whether you're profitable, wildly profitable, or, you know, you're out of business in 90 days. And so it's that really brings me to this point that as people who are thinking like Fred, you know, and I know the Fred factor is corny. I wrote the book. Sometimes people say, you know, that title's corny, like I didn't figure that out. But, you know, it's memorable. I mean, it's catchy. It's fun. You know, it's the idea of a soundbite. We got to somehow break preoccupation and embed ourselves in people's brains before they pay attention to us. But the thing is that most businesses, when they become successful, start throwing money at their problems or at their customers. I always say replace money with imagination and replace capital with creativity. You got to outthink rather than outspend your competition. You got to outthink your problems rather than outspend your problems. And that's why I think entrepreneurs are successful, because, you know, when you're bootstrapping a startup, you got no money or limited money.
Right.
And so you've got to get really creative. I mean, some of the best, you know, gonzo marketing programs, you know, some of the best guerrilla marketing programs were born out of necessity. But when you got, you know, a $38 million ad budget, you can make all sorts of stupid mistakes and do all sorts of kind of boring print and radio advertising, thinking that, well, you know, we got the money, let's spend it. And so that's, you know, Fred creates value the old-fashioned way, through ingenuity.
Right, right. And so when, you know, Fred, you know, having sort of created these principles, at least given birth to them in your mind, you know, the first thing you talked about in your book was how Fred, you know, introduced himself to you and offered to put your mail in certain places when you were out of town so no one would get it, and he would drive down the street and say, hello, Mr. Sanborn.
Yeah, are you check out my house when I was out of town, right.
Yeah, I mean, this you know, I'm thinking to myself, I wonder if I wouldn't have thought Fred was a little bit creepy at first.
Well, certainly, you know, and that's come up before. You know, some people think, you know, that's creepy. But you got to understand, and of course, it's a little harder to communicate in a short book or even in a speech, but it was how Fred did it that made it not creepy. I mean, if he was driving by, just say hello. And no more different than if you had eaten at a restaurant on a regular basis and knew the wait person's name was Bill, and, you know, you saw Bill at the mall, he might say, hey, how you doing? You know, that's not creepy. The fact that Fred worked in the neighborhood every day, you know, he had a good reason, you know, a professional license, if you will, to be checking on things.
Right.
When I say he checked on my house while I was gone, it wasn't like he came over, you know, in the middle of the night. It was like if he knew I was out of town, obviously, you know, my mail was accumulating, you know, in the places where he'd put it when I was out of town, he would just kind of, you know, look around. Was there anything out of the ordinary? And the good news is, it never happened. But if he'd have seen that, you know, there was a crack in my front window or that my screen was cut, I guarantee you Fred would be the kind of guy that would have alerted somebody, probably me or more likely the local, you know, police, just to make sure that everything was okay.
And that's such a good point for your principal number three. It didn't cost him or his employer an extra penny.
No.
Create
no.
That kind of added value for you as a customer.
And I got to add something in here because I got a feeling most people listening to your show aren't cynics, but I meet them periodically. And every once in a while, somebody says, oh, you know, you're a shill for corporate America. You want us to work harder and not get paid more. To which I say, you know, what a crock of caca. I've worked with corporate America for 21 years, but I've not had a job in corporate America for 21 years. The best reason to do this stuff is for you.
Mm-hmm.
Fred's life is more enjoyable for Fred, first and foremost. Fred isn't doing this out of some kind of compulsory obligation. He's doing it because he wants to. You know, and you got a choice. You got 8 hours a day. You can make it drudgery or you can make it mastery. You know, you can make it art or you can make it schlock. So, you know, to the cynic, I would say, you know, take responsibility and do it first and foremost because you can and you want to. If you're doing it because, you know, you have to, you know, if your boss made you read the book, and I sometimes meet people who have got a certain amount of displaced aggression that they had to read the book because their boss believed in the message, but they didn't.
Yeah.
I say, look, do it for you. You know, Helen Keller said, and I think you might remember this quote in the book, she said, is life not a thousand times too short to bore ourselves?
That's a really good one. Well, Fred certainly doesn't seem to be the type of person that could be bored with what he's doing. He certainly left an impression on you and us through the book. We're going to take our last break and come back with Mark Sanborn, author of The Fred Factor, and talk about the last principle and a little bit more about how we can get Fred-educated and implement some of these principles into our lives. This is Indie Business Radio. We'll be right back.
Want to stay on top of what's new in the radio industry? Sign up for a free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio, available exclusively to listeners of globaltalkradio.com, and find out what's new in the world of online radio. Listeners can find out about new shows and special guests. People with something special to offer can find out how to become a guest and how to prepare for an interview. And prospective hosts will find a valuable resource for everything from planning their new program to selecting topics and guests, recouping expenses by selling advertising, and more. Sign up today for your free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio by visiting www.globaltalkradio.com and learn about the future of talk radio today.
Welcome back to Indie Business Radio. This is Donna Maria, and we're here this afternoon with Mark Sanborn, author of The Fred Factor. If you have a question or comment, we invite you to call it in, 800-773-0355. Mark, before we took our break, we were talking about the third principle, the third Fred principle, and one of the things that I love that you have here in this particular section of the book is just this sentence. It says, Fred is more likely living proof that there is another less observable competitor, that is, less observable than your traditional competitors, and that is the job we could have done as our major competitor. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, you bet. There's the job we do, and there's the way the job's always been done, but I think a good philosophical question would be to ask yourself, is the fact that you're doing the job you currently have make the job more valuable to the people who benefit from it, whether those are customers or colleagues or you know, people that you serve in the community? The job we could have done is our potential. The job we're doing is our actual performance. And I include myself in here when I say none of us has ever reached our highest potential. You know, a lot of times you hear speakers say we only use 10% of our brain. The reality is that statistic is based on really dubious comments made in the 1920s. We probably use a lot more than 10% of our brain, but I am very confident in saying in my informal study of the subject and people who know far more than I do about the brain is we do not use all of the capability of our brains. Nobody probably ever has. and nor do we live to our peak potential. I sometimes do an exercise in my when I speak to an audience, and I ask them to write down how fast they think a human being could ride a bicycle. And, you know, people come up with all sorts of numbers, but I've yet to have anybody that wasn't familiar with this particular record come up with the answer, and that is in 1985, John Howard rode a bike to a speed of 151 miles an hour. And then in the mid-90s, a European cyclist hit 166 miles per hour. And the reason that I tell people that isn't because they're necessarily interested in bicycle land speed records, but to point out the difference between what we believe is possible and what actually is possible. Whenever somebody says what's possible, we always think backwards, and we think about what's probable. So what's possible is a different question. So the job you could have done is what's possible. It's the job you could do with a little more creativity, a little more passion, a little more commitment, a little more originality. And that's our ultimate competitor, not somebody else who does the same job, but what we were capable of doing that we chose not to do.
Well, yeah, and if you think about it, Mark, let's just say you do have a business that has competitors that provide services or products that are similar to yours. What they don't have, right, is you.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's I hear people say it a lot, and it sounds a little corny, but it's true. I mean, people are the ultimate differentiation, the quality of the relationship you have with customers, even the value. Your value proposition is determined by the people who designed it and delivered it. You know, whether that's in a manufacturing environment, and you go all the way back to the original research and engineering, or it's in a services environment where, you know, you have a strategic plan and you've got employees that have to implement the plan. So people are the ultimate resource when they are, you know, when they A, understand that, and when they're B, committed to being that resource, being that differentiator. The problem is, you know, a lot of us go through a large part of our lives simply going through the motions, lacking that passion or enthusiasm for what we're doing.
And then kind of wondering why it's not working.
Well, yeah, exactly. And, you know, and that's really the fourth principle, is you can reinvent yourself every day. George Eliot, which, of course, was the pen name for a female writer, George Eliot said it's never too late to become who you might have been.
Right.
And I think that's such a great encouragement to me, especially when I've had a bad day the day before, you know, and I'm feeling like, you know, kind of an abject failure. As I realize, and this is the fourth principle, you can reinvent yourself every day. You get up in the morning with a chance to try it again and to do something different. And as long as you're doing something new and different, you've got hope.
Right. And so for people out there that have small businesses, and I emailed exchanged with a person this morning who said, you know, I've been in business for all these years and I'm tired of spending money, and it's just really interesting that we have you on the show today, because so many people do say, you know, I don't have any money, I've run out of money, essentially, you know. And do you think that a lot of times the mistake, looking back, is spending the money on the wrong things and focusing on the money as the biggest asset as opposed to yourself as the biggest asset you have?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. You know, to oversimplify in limited time, I think I would say, number one, you got to be doing the right things, and you got to be doing the right things given your budget. I mean, when I started out speaking, I do things today. I work with a website search optimization company that, you know, if you'd have told me 15 years ago the kind of money I'm spending on that project, I'd have said, you got to be kidding.
Right.
But I'm at a point now where I'm in a situation where that money is actually, in my assessment, necessary for the level of competitiveness and where I'm at with my business. So I think the big mistake people make, and I've seen this in professional services, I've seen it in speaking and consulting, is spending too much too soon. If you spend too much money too soon, it sets you back because it prevents you from going through the learning curve, you know, what we sometimes refer to as a school of hard knocks, and it also wastes, you know, money. The less money you have, the more valuable money becomes. You know, it's relative.
Right.
So when you got $100, you spend $98 on a set of business cards. That's a bad decision. You got $100,000. Maybe you're going to spend $500 on business cards that are really classy, and that might not be a bad decision. So a lot of those decisions are relative.
So before you started spending that kind of money, just using your example on search engine optimization, before you either decided to spend that money or even a long time ago when you first started out, maybe you didn't have that kind of money to spend.
Well, I certainly didn't have that kind of money, right.
Well, and so back then, if you can think back, you were applying some of these principles back then to distinguish yourself without spending the money, because obviously, you know, there's other conferences that, you know, were hiring people and people were picking you because of some of the things you were doing to make yourself stand out.
Right, but again, you know, out of necessity. I realized early on, even though I have a background in sales and marketing, that's not my primary passion, and so I decided that the best marketing tool I had was a really, really good speech, and that by really focusing on my craft, there would be somebody in the audience that heard me and would bring me to their group, you know, and it was that kind of viral marketing for me, especially in the early years, it was critical, and it's still important today. I mean, that is still my core value proposition as a speaker is, you know, both my content, my message, if you will, and the way I deliver it. However, I think that sometimes, you know, I've got some friends that are good speakers, but they love marketing, and so they focus primarily on perfecting their marketing skills. They've got a good product, but their marketing is what carries the day for them. So, it, you know, that goes back a little bit to your business philosophy, but it goes back to really what we started out with, and that is, what are you passionate about? Spend your time finding a way to convert your passion into profit. And that comes from focusing first on the passion, not first on the profit.
Right, and what you do really well. Mark, a word has come up a lot during our talk today, and that's the word leadership. I want to ask you what you've noticed about leadership and any differences between how men and women perceive that, men and women business owners specifically. One of the things that, you know, for small independent business owners and particularly women that I work with is there's a real challenge, sometimes a struggle to see ourselves as leaders. I think there's something about that word that just makes some people go, ugh. You know?
Well, and that's why I wrote my last book, which is You Don't Need a Title to Be a Leader, How Anyone Anywhere Can Make a Positive Difference. I think we all know that having a title isn't what makes someone a leader. You know, we all know people that have titles that we don't respect or follow, and if we do what they want us to do, it's out of compliance, not out of commitment. But in an enlightened organization, people get a title because they've demonstrated leadership ability. I think we all know that, but I think what we sometimes forget is that just because you have a title shouldn't prevent you from leading. And I define, you know, leaders as people who positively increase ROI, and I repurpose that acronym. It doesn't stand in my work for return on investment, but relationships, outcomes, and improvements.
Okay.
If you're in the workforce and you can build better relationships or enrich an outcome for a customer or suggest or implement an improvement, those are what I call little L leadership acts. And in my book, I have a lot of examples. Early in the book, I talk about Andrea, who is a receptionist at a small private school in Portland, Oregon. But she's also a counselor, and she's also a construction supervisor, and she's also a healthcare provider. What I point out is that Andrea is absolutely invaluable to this organization because she does so many roles that fall outside her job description, but that demonstrate this principle that you don't have to have a title to positively influence people in a lot of different areas.
Okay. And so that sort of dovetails with another book that you have out about that very topic.
Exactly. And if people are interested, and it's free to background the book, there's actually a white paper, an executive summary in the book at the site youdontneedatitle.com. It's also where I run my blog from, and if your listeners are interested, I periodically blog on topics primarily related to leadership and service, but sometimes stream of consciousness. So youdontneedatitle.com is where they can check out my latest book, and also, if they're interested, read kind of my latest intellectual output.
Well, we'll definitely check that out. Where can we go, Mark, to see you speak live? Where are you going to be coming up here soon?
Well, I do very few public events. I mostly work with private organizations and corporations, but if people would like to see some excerpts, some 20-minute video streams of live presentations, there's no cost to do that. They can check those out at www.marksanborn.com. And typically, I may only do one or two public appearances a year, meaning an open enrollment, and we don't have anything on the schedule for the balance of 2007, but if people check back periodically in the outside event, I do end up in their community, they'll know about it.
And for those who want to download a free chapter of The Fred Factor, we go to fredfactor.com, right?
Correct, yeah. No, for some odd reason, The Fred Factor was gone. It's just fredfactor.com.
Yeah, I was careful not to say that.
Yeah, no, you were great. Absolutely right.
Fredfactor.com, how passion in your work and life can turn the ordinary into the extraordinary. Mark Sanborn, thank you for joining us today here on Indie Business Radio. We're really excited to have your insights.
Thanks. It's been fun to be with you. Thanks for listening, and I hope if any of your listeners are interested, they'll check out the websites, and they can contact me directly through there if they have a question or a comment.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Indie Business Radio is produced by Indie Business Media, LLC. Join the discussion at the Indie Business Blog at indiebusinessblog.com. You can stream or download all of my radio shows at the website indiebusinessradio.com. I'll be back next week with another exciting show. Until then, enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way.
You're listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com.